This episode sponsored by Apollo Neuro.
Having problems getting a good night's sleep? Apollo Neuro may be the help your body needs. Apollo Neuro is a wearable designed to calm your nervous system so you can fall asleep faster and sleep deeper without medication or side effects. It works by sending gentle, silent vibrations through your wrist that signal safety to your body, like a hug for your nervous system. The result? Fewer wake-ups, deeper sleep, and mornings where you actually feel rested. It's not just a sleep tracker. Apollo actively helps you regulate your body, and Smart Vibes AI automatically personalizes the experience for sleep, calm, focus, and recovery. It's scientifically backed, with clinical trial participants gaining up to 60 minutes of sleep a night. Try it risk-free for 30 days. Visit apolloneuro.com/audio and take $99 off today.
All right, Matt. So last night I made some gumbo, and I only put in the gumbo okra and sausage. You know, it wasn't bad. Wasn't good either. It was just mediocre.
Man, I could not get there. I was like, what the heck? What is going to be the punchline for this?
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales. All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
I'm doing about mediocre. I mean, seriously.
Good. Yeah, no, I'm with you. And it's been one of those weeks, man. Ashley and I were looking at our calendars the other day. Now, granted, she has more in her calendar because 98% of them, probably like you, 98% of them are meetings with other people. But for me, my calendar is packed. And I don't understand why it's so packed. It shouldn't be, but wearing me out, man.
Yeah, it seems like we're in prom and formal season, and it just seems like we looked at this week and it was like, oh, we got all this, you know, the weekend's going to be busy, but yeah, and then it's just been like this week has been like, we've been run over by a train. We've been so busy.
Right. Right. Yeah. I don't get it. But before we get off into complain tales here, I'll say go over and check out patreon.com/graveyardtales. If you're watching the video, you can look up here, scan the QR code, and head straight over to patreon.com/graveyardtales. Sign up to become a patron if you're not already. We have three different levels on Patreon, 1, 5, and 10. All of our levels get a bonus episode a week. So no matter what you sign up for, you're going to be getting a shorter, like, Graveyard Tales episode, basically, is how we describe it. It's usually topics that we would discuss on Graveyard Tales, but there's not enough meat on that bone to get a full episode out of. So you get a Patreon episode on it. Then if you move up to the $5 level, you get the bonus episode. Plus, if we do an ad that week, you get the ad-free audio and video versions of that episode. If we don't do an ad, we're not going to post the ad, because it's already ad free.
Right,
so, but anyway,
we're going to make one up and put it in.
Yeah, I'll
just
start
just
reading.
For y'all.
Yeah, just start reading weird ads that we.
You're
going to
be like, man,
have.
This thing sounds awesome. How do I get it?
Yeah,
it doesn't.
And at
exist.
The very, very end of the ad, we go psych.
Yeah,
not a thing. But then if you move up to our $10 a month, you get all of that plus. You get our second show, Side Quest, which is a totally different thing that Matt and I are doing. It's sometimes we eat weird stuff. We've eaten snacks from around the world. We've eaten nasty jelly beans. Ugh. We've drank weird sodas. I still taste the one of the sock jelly bean.
Oh, God.
The dirty socks jelly bean. I'll wake up with nightmares over that one.
Listen, I did not throw up, but I got,
you did good.
I got close.
Yeah, you did good, man.
I just knew.
I knew I was going to have you barfing on that one, but we also like to play games. Matt likes to test my knowledge, and he forgets that I'm a dummy. But he likes to test my knowledge and see how dumb I really am. And I like to tell him historical stories and sometimes survival stories. So check it out. Think you'll like it no matter which level you pick. We appreciate you very, very much. We probably wouldn't be doing this show still if we didn't have patrons who supported us like our patrons do.
100%.
Matt, on that note, why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
Okay, so tonight we head deep into the Nevada desert, out past the dry lake beds, the empty highways, and the kind of wide open silence that makes you feel like maybe you shouldn't be out there after dark. Because tucked away near the town of Lovelock sits a cave that has become the center of one of America's strangest legends. It's a place where archaeologists uncovered ancient tools, mummies, and human remains buried beneath centuries of bat guano.
Yummy.
Which, you know, that is not how anyone hopes to make a historic discovery. Okay,
true.
Covered in bat crap. But alongside the real archaeology came something much stranger. Stories from the northern Paiute of a violent enemy tribe known as the Sateka. Red-haired, fierce, sometimes said to be cannibals, living on rafts in marshes, and in later retellings, they were giants.
Mm-hmm.
But were they really giants? Or was this simply just a rival tribe remembered through generations of oral history? Or is this one of those stories where history and folklore get together and have this weird baby, and now we're all stuck trying to explain it? So tonight, Adam and I are talking about red-haired giants, ancient warfare, giant skeletons, cannibalistic legends, biblical Nephilim theories,
mm-hmm.
and yes, even the Kandahar giant. Because apparently once you start talking about giant redheads in caves, things get out of control. This is Graveyard Tales.
They really do.
So tonight,
they really do.
We're going to dig into the mystery of the red-haired giants of Lovelock Cave.
Right. So go check our sources. Down at the bottom of the show notes, you can find where we found all this information. You can see that everything we talk about is sourced and referenced down in the bottom of the show notes. And hopefully, y'all enjoy this rabbit trail that Matt and I ended up down, because he's right. Once you start diving into this, you end up in some places you didn't think you would go.
Right.
I know Matt and I were talking before, a couple days ago, when we were still pulling all the notes together and stuff. And he's like, okay, I ended up in this one spot. What is that guy's name?
Yeah.
And can you? And so we went to something we had talked about 6 months ago. And that came up again. So anyway, I think you're going to enjoy the rabbit trails we took. But like Matt said, out in the dry, open stretches of Nevada, near the town of Lovelock in Churchill County, there's a cave that at first glance, it doesn't seem especially remarkable or, you know, anything real special about it. But beneath its surface lies one of the most important archaeological sites in the Great Basin. Lovelock Cave sits just south of the Humboldt Sink, beside what was once the ancient lake bed of Lake Lahontan. Now, thousands of years ago, this region looked very different. The cave itself formed as a rock shelter carved by wave action back when water shaped that landscape. So that area had a bunch of like it was flooded over mm-hmm. in that area. And this cave was from waves hitting the rock and carving it out. Well, later, an earthquake caused part of the overhang at the entrance to collapse, so it created the structure that we see today, known as Lovelock Cave. Now, for thousands of years, people used this cave, but its modern discovery came by accident in the 1910s when guano miners, digging for bat droppings to use as fertilizer, uncovered something unexpected. Artifacts stuck within the poop.
Yeah, nice.
So, if you think
nothing,
your job
nothing
sucks,
preserves these artifacts better than bat crap.
Right, right. And I just want to say, if you think your job sucks, at least you're not digging for bat droppings.
Yeah, no joke.
So, go in tomorrow with a good attitude and tell your boss, thank you for not making me shovel guano. If you are shoveling guano, I'm sorry that I made that joke. By 1912...
Well, you're probably very well off because it's amazing what people use guano for.
That's true. You probably, despite having the bad job, you probably have more money than me and Matt put together and laugh at us like, for our job.
You know, I'll wear my poop-covered boots all the way to the bank. You know,
no joke. Well, by 1912, archaeologists began excavating the site, and what they found was extraordinary. More than 10,000 specimens were recovered, including baskets, textiles, tools, and human remains, some dating back as much as 4,000 years. Now, what makes Lovelock Cave so significant isn't just the number of artifacts, but what they revealed. The site offers a detailed look into everyday life in the ancient Great Basin. So among the discoveries were arrow points, carved objects like owl effigies, and even an antique duck call. So this is Duck Dynasty's start right here. And they got started in Lovelock Cave 4,000 years ago. If you ever wondered where the long beards and duck calls started. But one of the most well-known finds was a set of tool duck decoys, 11 in total, including 8 finished and 3 unfinished examples, so you could see how, you know, the process of them being made. These were carefully crafted from bundled tool reeds, decorated with feathers and paint, and they're considered some of the oldest known decoys ever discovered, demonstrating both sophisticated hunting techniques and skilled craftsmanship. And that's amazing to me. We know that people have hunted duck for centuries. Mm-hmm. We know that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why it didn't dawn on me that these people who watch nature as much as they do realize that if there's a duck, the other ducks are going to land. And so let's put decoys out and bring them in. So, I don't know why I thought decoys were a more modern invention.
So for the folks listening that are like me and didn't realize what tool was, it's like a reed, it kind of looks like bamboo. It's thin, you know, it grows in marshes. You know what it looks like. I mean, yep. You just might not know what it is. But when you look at these decoys that they found, these things they're amazing that mm-hmm. they're made out of these reeds. I mean, it's not just some little rudimentary thing. I mean,
right.
These are legit duck decoys made from this.
Yes.
I mean, you talk about like the guys that make their own fishing lures. I mean, this is impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and they're 2,000 years old.
Yeah, and they're so impressive, Matt, that they have been named Nevada's state artifact.
I thought you were going to say state bird. I was like, an artificial duck is their state bird?
Artificial duck is Nevada's state bird. No, it's their state artifact. And I didn't know states had state artifacts.
Oh, I didn't either. I've never heard that.
So now I'm going to have to go look and find out what Tennessee and Texas's state artifacts are, if we even have one. I don't know if we have one.
Let's see. Tennessee has a state artifact, which is a stone statue of a kneeling man.
Interesting. Yeah,
it's a Native American artifact that's from approximately 1250 to 1350 AD. I had no idea.
Yeah, me either. Texas, I don't know if you looked that up, but my guess is it is a carved replica of a brisket. That's what I think Texas's state artifact is, a brisket.
Let's see. Texas state artifact is... it's lame. it's like a rock. It's a monumental hunting kit. It's at the Bullock, Texas State History Museum.
That is kind of lame.
It's important because it says it indicates human presence thousands of years earlier than previously believed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, important, but not a brisket like I had hoped.
It looks like it's like a whole collection of things, but
yeah.
You know, I had no idea this existed. So I've learned three new things tonight.
There you go. And when doing this research, I didn't know state artifacts were a thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I know state birds and flowers, but state artifacts, that was new to me. I'm still going to petition for a brisket as the Texas state artifact.
A mummified brisket.
Yeah, I've had some, Matt, that I thought might have been mummified because they were so tough and did disgrace to Texas brisket, but that's a whole nother thing. Now, the cave also preserved a wide range of plant-based items. Archaeologists uncovered basket fragments, woven containers, and trays, objects that rarely survive in other environments. There was also fishing gear present, including nets and some stone sinkers, showing how important lake and marsh resources were. Now, there was evidence of clothing as well. They found sandals made of plant fibers, reflecting practical adaptations to desert conditions. Hunting and trapping tools were also found, including snares and equipment used for both small and large game. More personal and symbolic items appeared too. Carved effigies like fish, crayfish, owls, and whales. These, to me, okay, you're in Nevada and you've got a whale effigy. These had to come from trade.
Oh, yeah.
In my thought process.
Yeah.
Like, you're trading a tool duck decoy to somebody and they're giving you a whale effigy, because where would you see a whale in Nevada?
True, unless there were, like, you know, coastal tribes or something like that. Come in that direction, or you kind of met in the middle.
Yeah, you know, you'd have had to meet with
and did trade, but I mean, it speaks to a much more sophisticated society than maybe we previously thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also points to what you and I have talked about before, where a lot of people say, "Well, these different groups are contained their area and they never mingled with people from different regions and stuff."
That's
like
right.
That. It's like, this is small scale because it's the same continent, but it can happen cross continent in my thinking, but that would take us down a whole nother trail and I don't have notes.
We've
on
got
that,
another so. Show about that. So
right, right. they also found shell beads and ornaments. So those two, I would say shell beads coming from coastal tribes where they got the whale effigy from. They found food processing tools like winnowing trays, and that points to the preparation of seeds and plant foods such as pine nuts. And the cave also contained human remains and burials, although a lot of these remains have been repatriated to the tribe. But I wanted to just do a quick rundown again of what was found in the cave. They found the tool duck decoys. That's the best known discovery, 11 woven tool decoys. They found basketry and containers. So they found fragments, trays, woven storage pieces, and other perishable plant fiber containers. They found fishing gear. So nets, stone sinkers, and stuff showing that lake resources were important. They found clothing and footwear. Sandals and other plant fiber items were there. They found hunting and trapping equipment. So bundles of snares, tools, and weapon-related items were found, including materials associated with hunting small and large game. They found the effigies, so carved fish, crayfish, owl, whale, other animal effigies. They found the food processing items, winnowing trays, and related items. And they found human remains. And let's reiterate the human remains. They found human remains. Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind as we get further into my notes and Matt's notes. What ties all these discoveries together is preservation. The cave's dry conditions protected organic materials, things like fibers, reeds, and textiles that would normally decay. So this gives archaeologists a rare look at ancient plant fiber technology, not just stone tools. So it offers a more complete picture of daily life. Up until this point, the only thing they could find were stones that made it through the conditions for thousands of years. Well, taken together, the evidence shows a flexible, seasonal way of living. The people who used Lovelock Cave relied on a range of resources, marsh plants, fish, birds, seeds, and small game, rather than depending on just a single food source. Culturally, the site is strongly connected to the ancestral history of the Northern Paiute. The Paiute are one of the major native peoples in the Great Basin, with traditional homelands across what is now Nevada, Utah, California, and Arizona. Their way of life centered around hunting and gathering, moving seasonally to follow available resources rather than living in a permanent settlement. The Lovelock region itself was once part of a much richer environment, shaped by ancient Lake Lahontan and later by wetlands and marshes. These ecosystems supported fish, birds, tool reeds, and edible plants, making the area an important hub for some subsistence and travel. The cave was part of a broader indigenous landscape that was used continuously over thousands of years. Some interpretations refer to what's known as the Lovelock culture, and there are Northern Paiute oral traditions that speak of conflict between tribes in the area for use of the resources that add a whole nother layer to the site's history, which we'll talk about. But today, the legacy of Lovelock Cave continues. The tool duck decoys, once tools of survival, became a cultural symbol. So much so, like I said, Nevada made them the state artifact in 1995. What began as a guano mining operation ultimately revealed one of the most detailed archaeological records in the region, a place where daily life, survival, and craftsmanship were preserved for thousands of years. Now, I mentioned there were conflicts. There's a legend that the Paiute have about the conflict in the area, and especially around Lovelock Cave. It's probably why you clicked on this episode, because we all know the name Lovelock. So let's look at the legend real quick. Long before Lovelock Cave was mapped, studied, or written into history, it stood in the Nevada wilderness as something older and something remembered. To the Paiute people, this land was never empty. It was alive, but not always in ways that felt welcoming. The marshes shifted and breathed. The reeds whispered in the wind. The remnants of ancient water stretched across the basin like ghosts of another world. It was a place where survival came at a cost, and where not everything moved in the open. From that world comes a story of something feared. They were called the Siteka. In Paiute tradition, they were not like ordinary people. They were described as tall, powerful, and in some tellings marked by fiery red hair. Figures that seemed to stand apart in a way that felt wrong, not just different, but unnatural. They moved with the wetlands themselves, drifting silently across the water on tule rafts, appearing without warning, vanishing just as quickly, never staying where they could be followed, never showing themselves until it was too late. The conflict that followed was not a single battle, but something longer, heavier. A slow, grinding war that stretched across seasons and generations. Raids in the dark, retaliation at dawn, a cycle that refused to end. And in the Great Basin, that kind of conflict meant something deeper, because this was not a forgiving land. Water was survival. Food was survival. Territory was survival. The marshes, the lake edges, the caves, these were not just places. They were the difference between life and death, and whoever controlled them endured. In the telling, the conflict builds until it reaches a breaking point, like something inevitable, like it was always going to end this way. And it ends at Lovelock Cave. The Paiute and their allies drove the Setikha back across the marsh, across the open land, forcing them into the cave, into the dark. And then they closed it. Brush was piled at the entrance, a fire was started, and at first it was just smoke. Then there was more. It filled the cave, thick and suffocating, pressing into every space and every breath. The air turned against those trapped inside. The darkness closed in around them. The cave became something else, not shelter, refuge, but a trap, a furnace, and a tomb. Those who tried to escape were cut down at the entrance, and those who stayed inside were left with no way out, no light, no air, no future. Then there was nothing, no voices, no movement in the cave, just silence. But it's that silence that lingers, because this is more than a story about an enemy. It's a story about something that doesn't fully disappear. In the Paiute telling, the Setikha are not just remembered, they are felt. Their presence shaped into something that lives on in the place itself. And Lovelock Cave became more than stone and history. It became a place where something ended violently, and where, depending on who tells the story, something may not have ever truly left. But even now, the cave sits quiet in the Nevada desert, but places like this have a way of holding on to what happened inside them. And sometimes, it doesn't always stay completely silent.
So, Adam just walked us through the archaeological history and the Paiute legend of the Setikha. These are the so-called tool eaters. And honestly, you know, with what you just heard Adam say, if the story stopped right there, that would already be creepy enough. You know, a hostile enemy tribe living on these reed rafts, ambushing people from the marshes, and eventually trapped inside a cave and burned alive. I mean, that's not folklore. That's a horror movie.
Right.
But this is Graveyard Tales. So naturally, someone has to ask, okay, but were they giants? You know, where did the giant thing fit in? Because apparently regular enemies just aren't exciting enough. We need to have giants too. And preferably red-haired giants. And make them cannibals. Okay?
Yep, please.
So, and if we can somehow connect them to the Bible or ancient aliens or a government cover-up, that's even better.
Right.
So, that's exactly what happened with Lovelock Cave. Because this history just never died down. It never went away. It stayed and endured for thousands of years to give us what we're looking at today and going, maybe they were giants, you know? What's right. What's really going on here? You know, and it is, as Adam said at the top of the show, it is one of the most famous giant legends in America. And the biggest reason that it is one woman. And her name is Sarah Winnemucca. Now, if you're going to talk about the Sita Ka, you have to start with Sarah Winnemucca. She was the daughter of Chief Winnemucca and one of the most important Northern Paiute voices in the 19th century. In 1883, she published her book called Life Among the Paiutes, Their Wrongs and Claims. And in that book, she talks about a tribe her people had supposedly exterminated long ago.
Hmm.
Yeah, I said exterminated. Okay.
Them's is harsh
that's
words,
right. Matt. You know, that's what you do to a pest. Okay.
Right.
So you can tell that there was no love loss here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she described them as, and this is the exact phrase, a small tribe of barbarians, which honestly sounds like the title of my first rock band, you know, a small tribe of barbarians. But she said they were violent, they were enemies, and most importantly, she said they were cannibals.
Mm-hmm.
According to her account, they would kill and eat members of neighboring tribes, which, let's be honest, it's a pretty fast way to become unpopular at community events. You know,
oh, yeah.
You don't get invited to Thanksgiving twice after that. You know? No. Don't invite them. They're going to eat us.
Yeah. When they say we're inviting you over for dinner, they don't mean what we mean.
How to cook for 40 humans, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think you added the four in there, just how to cook 40 humans.
Yeah, right. But here's the detail that changed everything. She wrote, quote, "My people say that the tribe we exterminated had reddish hair." Now, that's the line that everybody, you know, hangs on to. That's mm-hmm. the line that launched 1,000 History Channel documentaries that come on at 2:30 in the morning. Red hair. How many Native American tribes do you know have red hair?
None.
Right. None.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this wasn't just the enemy tribe gets defeated. This was like, wait, who are these redheaded people?
Yeah.
And Sarah added something even stranger. She claimed that her own family possessed ceremonial garments decorated with this reddish hair.
Mm.
So this wasn't just some distant legend. This was family memory.
Yeah, this was something hung on to to remember.
Yeah, this isn't grandma going once upon a time. This is grandma saying, see that weird red wig in the closet? Yeah, that belonged to the cannibal people.
Yeah, that's not a wig. That's a scalp. That's
right. So all of that changes things because oral tradition becomes much harder to dismiss when someone says, oh, no, we kept the hair.
Mm-hmm.
You kept the hair. Yeah. And that sounds like the beginning of a horror movie. I'm serious.
It really does, yeah.
So, were they actually giants? Now, here is where the modern story starts to kind of drift away. She did not specifically say, oh, yeah, and Greg was 9 feet tall and used buffalo as dumbbells. Okay?
Yeah.
That part came much later. But in earlier Paiute stories, the Sita Ka were described as more dangerous enemies than supernatural monsters. Now, large, maybe. Powerful, absolutely. But literal giants, it seems to get stronger in the later retellings. You know, that may have been embellished a little bit. And then come the guano miners. Okay, which that's still, I'm like, oh my God, you know, mining for poop, you know.
That's the start to a good documentary. Yeah. And then came the guano miners.
You don't expect the History Channel show to start with, Carl was elbow deep in bat poop, you know.
Yeah,
but
right,
here we are, right. You know.
His muck boots were filled with poop. Literal muck
boots. Yes, that's right. Literal muck boots. So in 1911, these miners are digging through centuries of bat guano in Lovelock Cave, and they started uncovering human remains. And the report started spreading fast. They found mummified bodies, large skeletons, red hair, huge sandals. And suddenly, everyone in Nevada was like, well, I guess giants are real.
Yep.
It's just instant, overnight. Giants are real. Hey, did you hear?
Done. Yep.
But one of the miners, a man named James H. Hart, later described finding what he called a striking-looking man of 6 feet tall with hair distinctively red. Now, today, 6 feet tall is just the guy who stands in front of you at every concert.
Yep.
But back then, and compared to many ancient remains, it was notable, especially if the surrounding skeletons were much smaller.
Right.
So that may be where the giant story really took off, because...
Yeah, in comparison.
Right.
They were giant.
Right. But in the retellings, 6 becomes 7, and 7 becomes 8, and then 8 becomes 10. And before long, someone on the internet was probably like, my uncle fought one of these at Bass Pro Shops.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
these
right.
gigantic Native Americans. But that's how folklore works. The later stories got even wilder, because people claimed there were 7-foot skeletons, 8-foot skeletons, 8.5-foot mummies, 10-foot skeletons, giant handprints, massive tools, and a sandal measuring about 15 inches long.
Wow.
Let me tell you something. Right now, on my foot is a sandal that measures 14 inches long. So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, but again, that's not so uncommon now. It would be then. I mean, we're talking about an ancient Shaquille O'Neal to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just at that time, it was unheard of. But here's the problem. There is no verified museum evidence for true 8 to 10 foot skeletons from Lovelock Cave.
There never is.
None. Yeah.
There never is.
The real archaeology just confirms human remains. It confirms mummified remains. And it confirms red hair. Not like NBA Nephilim, you know, nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
But all this other stuff, yeah, it's absolutely true. Now, most of the bigger giant claims came later from newspaper exaggeration, tourism stories, and fringe researchers. So it's basically like old-timey clickbait.
Right.
Kind of like, you won't believe what they found in this cave. And honestly, I would have probably clicked it too. That's kind of how I got to this, you know?
Yeah, right. That's how this episode was made.
So, why was the hair red? This is where science comes along and tries to ruin everybody's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Archaeologists say dark hair in ancient mummified remains often turns reddish brown over time because of oxidation, mineral exposure, and decomposition, meaning they may not have been natural redheads at all. They may have been brunettes who got chemistried into becoming gingers.
I have such an issue with this.
I know, Adam, he does not like this at all.
No, I don't, because I'll give you the misidentified large skeleton remains. I'll give you that. But the legend that I read, it didn't say anything about large giants, right? But the original legend did say that the tribe had red hair. So, why do you have to go and say it's environmental chemical staining?
Right. Exactly.
The legend itself said red hair, and they're not, this isn't a embellishment of the original legend, because again, they didn't say they were fighting giants with red hair. They said they were fighting a tribe with red hair, and they were a powerful tribe. So I'll give you the giant part was added on, but you're just being obstinate when you're saying that this group didn't have red hair, though everything says they had red hair, and the remains said they had red hair, and the Winnemucca's daughter said they kept the red hair.
Right. That's it. And so before we started the show, Adam and I were kind of going back and forth, like we knew what the hell we were talking about. But as far as this oxidation of brown or black hair, well, that's another thing. I don't see I just don't see a lot of people that are Native American, truly, not like, you know, my great 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 grandmother knew a guy that was Native American, and so I'm part Cherokee. You know, that right. Kind of, you hear people say that all the time, especially down here. And, you know, but
I have Native American blood, but it's so far removed. There's no reason for me to even say, like, it's great, great, great grandparents or something.
I'll tell you that, not to go too far off, but in Tennessee, this was Cherokee land. And so growing up, I had always been told that we had Cherokee heritage. And right. I learned about a year ago that that was not true. Not that we didn't have Native American heritage. We absolutely do. It's Navajo. And, you know, it's amazing what you can discover now with all of these genealogy sites and everything. And you can actually track down way more records than you could even 10 or 15 years ago.
Right. I need to look it up, Matt, because I have Caddo Indian in my heritage. I need to see if we might have been enemies.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, If so, we might need to stop this show. If I
leg wrestle one night on the show.
There you go.
But I mean, yeah. I don't run around telling people
like, you know, your side quest with toe wrestling. We'll do toe wrestling.
But I don't tell people, oh, I'm Native American. I mean, it would be the equivalent of it being at least three or four greats grandparent. Right. Okay,
same for me.
So. Yeah. At some point, I think someone figured out in our family would be like 1/16th or 1/32nd. That's not enough, you know. It's interesting. I like the fact that I know that now and have something to verify it. But out of all of that, and going off on that tangent, most of the people that I have met, you know, seen photographs of, everything, their hair is much more black than it is brown. So, you know, I'm a self-proclaimed moron when it comes to this stuff. Do some Native American tribes have more brownish hair as opposed to more black hair? I'm not saying everybody's got jet black hair. But I don't see anybody walking around that is truly Native American that looks like, you know, dirty blonde or really sandy hair. You don't see that. That would be the color that I would think as a non-archaeologist would oxidize to a reddish brown color. Back before my hair was gray, it became a reddish brown color. And now it's just completely gray. But, I mean, you know, you could kind of see as I aged, it went from that sandy blonde color to this reddish brown mm-hmm. color. That's what I would expect. I would expect if it was black and it oxidized, it would either stay black or it would become a different shade of gray. But again, yeah. I don't know. I mean, they're basically saying these people's hair rusted.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, though. The hair that they had on the garments that they had saved, mm-hmm. they didn't pass down that, this hair was this color when we cut it off of them and then put it on our garments, and it has turned red over time. It has always been red. They said, this is the red hair from this tribe.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not like, even if it could oxidize outside of the guano cave and become the same color, they didn't. The ancestors that had these garments didn't say, when we put the hair on there, it was a dark brown and now it's become red over time. They said, this is the red hair. Yeah. So I don't know why the archaeologists have to say that it was chemical staining. What makes them go for that? I know it can happen, but when your legend is of red hair, when the people that have some of the hair, claim to have some of the hair, said it was red hair and still is red, why not just go, it's probably red. What is the point of trying to say it was oxidized? You know what I mean?
I don't know. Archaeologist Adrian Mayer has written about this and argues that the red hair mystery is probably mostly explained by preservation conditions, but I don't claim to be an archaeologist. I do claim to argue with a fence post. I have absolutely no background and no authority to say otherwise, but.
Well, and we like to play devil's advocate too on these shows.
But I just, with the way that it's in the legend, I just feel like, why are we so focused on debunking the red hair? That's not the most unusual aspect of this story,
right?
The red hair. Right. I mean, it's as unusual as it may be.
Yeah, you just said it better than I did, but that was my point.
You know, so I'm like, why are we hammering this so bad? But nonetheless, it's not as much fun. I mean, it's a lot more fun to imagine these guys had this flaming red hair. And I don't know. I really don't. I have no way to prove or disprove this, but I do take the book by Sarah Winnemucca as at least, you know, factual. I mean, I can't imagine in 1883 she had any reason to make it up, but.
Right.
But anyway, so we're questioning, were they giants? We're questioning, did they really have red hair? Well, let's question the next thing. Were they cannibals? Well, let's talk about cannibalism, because this part really gets repeated a lot. Sarah Winnemucca said they were cannibals. Paiute tradition strongly supports that idea. Some remains and cut marks found in Lovelock Cave have been interpreted by some writers as possible evidence. But archaeologists tend to tread lightly here, because cut marks do not automatically mean, this was a giant people buffet. It could mean burial practices or ritual treatment or warfare or famine survival or enemy propaganda. But let's be honest, every culture in history has had at least one rival tribe that they described as monsters and they're probably eating babies. I mean, that happens a lot. So could they have been cannibals? Probably, possibly, maybe, I don't know. Is there definitive proof that they were? No. But from a folklore perspective, Red Hair Cannibal Giants is obviously much more memorable than complicated funerary customs among regional tribal groups. I'm not clicking that. No one buys that t-shirt, okay?
Right. When you have to run the t-shirt saying onto the back to
yeah,
make
that's
it
right.
fit, I'm not buying
it's gotta
that
wrap
shirt.
Around.
Mm-hmm.
Now, believe it or not, here's one of the weirdest parts of this whole story. One of the best preserved mummies found in Lovelock Cave was reportedly boiled. Yeah,
oh, wow.
Boiled. Because a local fraternal lodge wanted the skeleton for initiation ceremonies. And that is not a joke. This is an actual part of the historical record. Imagine discovering one of the greatest archaeological finds in Nevada history, and Earl from the lodge says, "Boys, I got an idea."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that poor archaeologist probably just started in the into the middle distance like he was in Vietnam. Okay?
Yeah.
One of those moments where history proves reality is stranger than fiction, because no writer would put that into a script.
Well, leave it to somebody trying to get an initiation ceremony.
Yeah.
And they were probably drunk when they came up with this idea. And they said, let's take one of these amazing archaeological discoveries.
Yeah.
We can boil it. And we can use it to scare initiates.
Yep. And understand, we're not talking about like, you know, a college fraternity. We're talking like, you know, the local 231, you know, the Elks Lodge or something like that.
Yep.
That this kind of fraternal
yep.
organization. That is who
That's
that
why
is who
I said
did
they
this.
Had to be drunk.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had to be drunk because a college student would just do it.
Yeah, right. They would just
drunk
do
or
it
not. They would
on
just,
a dare. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But the other guys, at least they would be drunk to think that was a good idea.
But let's look at some other aspects of the giant legend and see if we can make some comparisons here. Cause this is one of my favorite guys. Adam turned me on to this guy, and so it kind of went down a rabbit hole with his research and everything. It's a guy named Timothy Alberino.
Dude, you can go down 100 rabbit trails with this guy.
If you like the giant legends, okay, Timothy Alberino is your guy. You already know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
But he does not take the maybe they were just tall approach. He goes full bore, okay?
Yep.
For Alberino, Lovelock Cave fits into a much bigger global pattern. He connects the Sitka to biblical giants, the Nephilim, pre-flood hybrid beings, suppressed giant skeleton discoveries, and the idea that ancient giant tribes may have survived far longer than mainstream history admits. Basically, if Indiana Jones and Ancient Aliens had a very intense cousin, this is Timothy Alberino, okay?
Right.
But he talks about the Sitka as possibly a surviving giant bloodline. He points to the red hair. He points to oversized skeleton claims. He points to the oral traditions, and he asks, what if this wasn't myth? What if it was memory? And this ties directly into one of the most famous modern giant stories, the Kandahar Giant.
Mm-hmm.
And folks, this one gets really weird. It blows me away.
Yeah. I've listened to this story two or three times.
I know.
Like him tell this story two or three times. Every time I hear it, something else about it catches my ear. And I'm like, what?
Yep.
What? Really?
If you're not familiar with it, honestly, go find it. But we're going to kind of give you a synopsis now. Okay. So the story goes like this. In 2002, during military operations in Afghanistan near Kandahar, a U.S. Special Forces unit reportedly encountered something impossible. A giant. And not like that dude is tall. I mean, allegedly 12 to 15 feet tall, red haired, massive, wearing primitive animal skins and living in a cave. Sound familiar? This is in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Apparently, this thing ambushed a patrol and killed one soldier by impaling him with a spear, which is a sentence I didn't expect to say today. The soldiers opened fire a lot, and according to the story, it took sustained fire to bring this thing down. Then, because conspiracy stories always need act three, a military helicopter supposedly arrived, loaded the body and flew it away. But government silence. No official record, no confirmation, just stories, which of course means the internet said, perfect, giants, real, you know.
Yep.
Now, mainstream evidence for the Kandahar giant is basically non-existent. Okay, there are no official military reports. There are no photographs. No public confirmation. Most researchers consider it folklore, military rumor, or modern myth, like basically an urban legend. But Timothy Alberino sees it differently. To him, Kandahar and Lovelock are part of the same pattern. Red-haired giants, cave dwellers, ancient bloodlines, a hidden history that refuses to stay buried, and whether you believe it or not, it's hard not to notice the similarities. Okay, the red hair, the cave, violent, large, killed in dramatic fashion. I mean, if Netflix was going to make this into a series, I'd binge it all in one night. Sure. You know, and I really just scratched the surface on this Kandahar giant story. Okay, because Alberino claims that The man that actually flew the helicopter that picked up this giant told him this story face to face.
Right. And there's a lot more detail with how he picked it up and all that stuff that if you go check out Timothy Alberino in one of the many interviews he's done, your jaw will be on the floor either in shock or in disbelief, yep, because you don't believe in giants and you're amazed that this is right out there, or you do believe in giants and you're like, what? Yeah. Like, but I did,
you know, when you listen to him tell it, you know, I said the actual hard evidence is not there, but there's a lot of hearsay evidence and people that he references that he has either spoken to or he has seen written communication from that reference something like this. And so he says he has seen a lot more evidence than what the public will probably ever see. I mean, including communications from the Secretary of State regarding this situation. Right. So,
wild.
I'm always skeptical, but I always feel like, you know, where there's smoke, you know, I mean, they're talking about something, you know, they're discussing something. People get weird and get all quiet when you bring it up to, you know, higher ranking individuals. So it's kind of like the UFO thing, you know, how many people do we need to hear discuss it? How regular, you know, normal, respected people need to say, hey, you know what? I saw whatever, till we finally go, let's investigate this a little bit more. Let's quit blowing it off. And I think this is definitely one of those stories.
True. And if it's true that what he says about when he brings it up, people changing the conversation, walking away, not wanting to talk about it. If that's true, then here's my question. If the giant is or was not real, why go that direction.
Right.
Why not just say, dude, you're dumb.
Exactly.
Quit bringing that up and leave it alone. But if everything, if he's being honest and everybody else is being honest about what they saw, then why are they doing it that way? Why are they like, I can't talk about that.
Yeah.
You know, instead of just, dude, I'm not talking about that because it didn't happen.
Why perpetuate it with that?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess some of these kind of legends about other things, I guess I can see. Well, let's just a quick example, UFOs. So you start talking about UFOs and aliens with certain individuals that are high ranking and they are like, hush, hush, stop. I don't want to talk about this. I can't. They leave and they act weird. And you're like, is that confirmation? Well, maybe not. But with at least with UFOs, you could think, okay, they don't want to get into this because, you know, maybe these organizations like Lockheed Skunk Works and other places, maybe they have reverse engineered something. Maybe they do have technology mm-hmm. that everybody doesn't want. They don't want everybody knowing about, especially other countries. So they're not going to discuss it because they don't want that to come up. So everything's mm-hmm. off the table. What is this going to do? I mean, what is Giants going to do? I mean, really?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm with you, Adam. You know, why not just completely laugh and go, man, I cannot, you've heard that story too. You know, I can't believe people believe that. And that, I've heard this version. Which version did you hear? Why aren't they like that? And just completely blowing it off. Why are they acting like, oh, crap, I can't talk about this? You know, it just seems odd, you know, unless you've got that many people that just have fun perpetuating these little legends by acting this way, which I don't believe. Because I think I would be like, man, dude, this is totally stupid. Why are you even talking about this?
I'm tired of this. It didn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Now, the strongest version of this story may not be proof of biblical giants. It may be something even stranger, that there was probably a real enemy tribe, real conflict, real violence, and real death. And over generations, the memory became legend, and the legend became giants, and then the giants became myth. But myths start somewhere. Something happened at Lovelock Cave, something bad enough that people remembered it for centuries. And maybe the scariest possibility isn't that giants existed, but that humans are perfectly capable of becoming monsters all by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and like you were saying, behind the legend, think of it like a hailstone. And I bring up hailstones because we just had a hailstorm, but in order to get a hailstone, you have to have one little grain of something for the ice and water to be trapped around. Dust, sand, something. And then the hail grows around it. So the legend, there's something true that started this legend. I tend to believe the Paiute legend of there was a red-haired tribe that we fought. We were warring with for the right to use these marshes and stuff. And we killed them and buried them in this cave or trapped them in the cave and burned them out, whatever. And then over years, like you said earlier, the 6-foot tall guy became 8, became 10. And then it got tied to other stories of giants. But then my question is, if that's the case, why do we have so many stories of giants?
Yeah, I'm with you there.
If it was just a tiny little embellished thing, why do all cultures seem to have a giant legend? Did everybody embellish it?
And
maybe.
And not only that, but all of these cultures have legends of giants that go back thousands of years and go back 20 years. and everything in between. So why so many? If there's nothing there, if it's absolutely false, it's just a myth, why so many? What do you guys think? Do you think there could be, well, specifically, do you think something happened at Lovelock Cave? It seems like something absolutely did. I mean, there is enough historical evidence that something happened there. Okay. Whether or not you believe there were giants, they were red hair, they were cannibals, whatever, you know, let us know. And the best place to do that is in our Facebook group. This is where we have so many people coming in, you know, asking questions, sharing ideas. You know, we've had folks ask for help with weird paranormal problems. Mm-hmm. We've got people sharing dad jokes. It's a great place. We have thousands of people in there. Just search Graveyard on Facebook and you'll find it.
Great bunch of people.
Don't forget to go to our website, which is graveyardpodcast.com. And there you can find links to purchase Graveyard Tales merchandise. Hey, you need a new pair of shorts to hang out in the yard this summer. We got Graveyard Tales shorts in there. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Get that Skull Mike or logo.
Click that link. I just changed it. That'll take you to merch.
Hey, Adam's getting better at pointing at the thing on screen.
I am. Yeah. I'm practicing.
But also, that is where you can become a patron. And hey, you know, road trip season is coming up and people are going to be taking a vacation. This is a great time. You know, sign up, become a patron, grab so much of that bonus content, you know, to listen to. You know, you got an 8-12 hour drive, whatever, you know, grab some Patreon bonus content, catch some episodes of SideQuest. We've got all kinds of stuff. I guarantee you there's something in there that you'll enjoy. So until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.